1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Nominated unanimously. He has been working tirelessly and has gone, as he just told me, throughout the whole state with the exception possibly of one county. He is working very hard to bring the support to the president that he so dearly needs. And I am happy to introduce to you the next U.S. Senator from the state of New York, the Honorable Jacob K. Javits. I am delighted to have made this trip here, and if I have helped in any way to augment the interest in the dinner, I'm very pleased. Yours is a very important organization coming from an important part of the state, and if we are to have success in the state in this election, it will take a tremendous drive by all of us everywhere, including what are considered to be steadfast counties in terms of our state. And so I hope that you will extend all your efforts for success in this election. Because my friends, very rarely in American elections does anything as dramatic happen as has just happened in respect of this election. Well, we have been talking constantly about the challenges to the peace leadership of the country. And we have, early in the campaign, discussed that in terms of what has happened. We talked about Geneva, we talked about Formosa, we talked about Adams for Peace, we talked about other matters. But here in the campaign have suddenly come three events of such monumental significance to our country and to the whole world, as to test every statement we have made in the hard crucible of reality instead of in the area of discussion. First, there was the proposal for abandoning H-bomb tests and shortcutting the draft, a vital proposal to our security in which the President and Governor Stevenson took diametrically opposite positions, in the sense that the President stood by the traditional American policy which demanded inspection and control through the UN as a basis for disarmament, that Governor Stevenson wished to, in essence, accept the thesis which had been put forward by the Russians for about 10 years for some kind of a paper treaty of outlawry. At the very best, this was the proposal. I'm not going to discuss that tonight. I will probably do that tomorrow in another place. And then came the momentous events behind the Iron Curtain, which indicated that the people behind the Iron Curtain in Poland and in Hungary were willing to accept the most extreme risks in a struggle for freedom. And I think that those occurrences were the most eloquent answer to the decriers of the fact that American prestige had fallen to new lows. Hardly conceivable that people behind the Iron Curtain running such dreadful risks would be willing to undertake a struggle for freedom if they felt a lack of confidence in the greatest democracy on earth, and whom they knew was the leader of the free world, and where they knew they would get help if they could possibly extricate themselves from the yoke of slavery which was around their necks. my friends, just a few days ago, there broke upon the world a crisis of the greatest magnitude, accompanied again, as it was in Hungary and Poland, by shooting, by the movement of armies in the Middle East. And again, our political opponents immediately invoked that as showing that our prestige had been shattered, our alliances dismembered, that everything had gone to pot in a handbasket. Now, no one underestimates the seriousness of these events, least of all I, for this is an area of the world in which I have long had a very deep and compelling interest, and which has an enormous interest, not only in terms of American security and free world security, but in terms of the emotional feeling of many Americans who are deeply concerned with the future and the fate of Israel. And so, my friends, this again presented to our president, whom we call the unparalleled leader for peace, an enormous challenge. But what I think has now been put in focus is this, that leadership for peace is shown not only in maintaining the peace. It is a fact that our forces have not been engaged in any struggle since January 1, 1953, in terms of our forces directly engaged in military action, following, in essence, rather not January 1st, but very close to that, following, in essence, the completion of the truce negotiations with respect to Korea, which came quite soon thereafter. But the leadership for peace, therefore, is not alone in maintaining the peace, because as happens in every phase of life, we can't control everything. We can do a great many things, but we can't control everything. But it's also leadership in pursuing the peace, to pursue it with steadfastness and courage when the peace has been broken. And it seems to me that this has happened. And again, we have had a display of the president's leadership, unusual leadership, in the temperateness and the wise application of policy, which the president has announced in his speech last night, and which in essence may be called no involvement for the United States in this particular area. Now, my friends, we would be less than adults, and we would be less than realistic if we didn't understand what that policy meant. And it would be my purpose today to endeavor to discuss with you briefly what I think that policy means, where it's going, where it ought to go, and what implementation is required to carry out its letter and it, as well as its spirit, and I emphasize the latter as much as the former. It means, of course, that no American blood is to be shed, and for that, of course, we thank God. But also, and very importantly, it must mean that we're equally committed to dealing with the intolerable provocations which preceded this outbreak and which must be settled with equal vigor and resourcefulness. These provocations included Arab boycott, blockade, border incursions, and troop movements so disruptive of the national life of Israel and the whole Middle East, as well as dictatorial seizure and handling of the Suez Canal crisis by Colonel Nasser, so menacing to the national life of Great Britain and France. And now the question that we have to face is, what do we do about it? Having declared this policy of the president that our forces, in terms of our armed forces, would not be involved. First, I think the president has lifted the crisis out of partisanship. And under his leadership, the United States will persist in its policy of ensuring the survival and territorial integrity of Israel and the settlement of the Suez dispute by peaceful means through the United Nations. Now, these are two tenets of United States foreign policy, which I only recapitulate, for they have been stated and restated throughout the development of this crisis from the very beginning of 1956. Now the policy of no involvement announced for the president, properly implemented, is designed to protect our vital interests, to bring peace to Israel and the Middle East, and to get final solutions at long last. It's a policy designed to preserve peace throughout the world. President Eisenhower said last night, from the beginning of Israel's existence, it's been, and I quote, a basic matter of the United States policy to support the state of Israel. Further, and this is of great importance, it seems to me, the president showed that the United States government will not seek unilaterally to impose sanctions on any nation for what has happened in the Middle East. Not upon Britain, not upon France, not upon Israel. In short, the president reasserted that the traditional bonds of friendship existed and reasserted his determination that whatever the conscience of the world dictated should be done, should be decided not unilaterally by the United States alone, but through the great conclave of nations, which is the General Assembly of the United Nations. My friends, I hope you will not find fault with me tonight for speaking to you most deliberately and not forensically, for I have chosen this forum away from New York, away from New York City, and a typically Republican forum to share with you a statement upon the foreign policy of our country, which is so portentous in terms of the Senate candidacy and in terms of the current campaign. I thought it was only fitting that it be made to a party audience, for this is essentially a policy which needs to be backed and implemented by the country and with the support of our party if we are going to get the mandate from the American people which we are seeking next Tuesday, this very, very few brief days away. And so, as Republicans, we must talk with the utmost seriousness about this great responsibility, which is ours, for the peace of mankind. And I speak with you in those tones, and I hope you will understand and not expect me to make a big dramatic speech under these circumstances, but to be very serious. These events which I have described, coincide with the end of our national political campaign and our New York campaign for the Senate. It seems to me, my friends, that it's important for all of us to understand that certainly at moments like this, not only must being in public office be responsible, but even campaigning must be responsible. To act irresponsibly now is to imperil our bipartisan foreign policy, detract from our president's support in his determination to save and maintain the peace of the world, endanger the lives of our own people, and hold out false counsel, perhaps, to the leaders of Israel. Partisan desperation at a stage like this can succeed only in confusing some who naturally are bewildered by what has happened. Now, I think it's very important that we all understand exactly what the president said, the implications of the policy of the United States, which he announced last night. And let us remember that this is a policy which came after the action by Israel and after the action by France and Great Britain, so that the whole picture was then before us. And a distinction should be made between the fullness of our policy in the face of the fullness of the occurrences, as distinguished from the statement of our government on October 29th, on Monday, when only part of the picture, which later developed, was then apparent. And therefore, I think we must understand what the president said in the light of those considerations. And I hope that the people of our state have noted with care the address that the president made to the nation. Our government has apparently recognized that the tripartite declaration of May 1950, which had been the subject of a White House statement on Monday and which dealt with aggression, was not applicable to this situation, though there had been the use of force and forces had moved out of their borders, as we all know. The president said that was an error, as we all know, in a speech last night. The president found that it is the Egyptians who, and I quote, aggravated needlessly the situation by an Egyptian policy, including rearming with communist weapons, that Israel felt, and I quote again, increasing anxiety for its safety, and that the seizure of the Suez Canal Company by Egypt brought on the present crisis. Now I have addressed earnest pleas throughout this campaign, and I voice it again. This is a policy that I pursued consistently in the Congress, as I think your own congressman can tell you. And that policy was, let us keep the issue of Israel an element of our bipartisan foreign policy. In this way, it has always done best in terms of U.S.-Israel relations and action in our country. Let us support the President in this policy of non-involvement to carry out the humanitarian role for which the entire world respects us. Let us help save the peace of the world and all that it means to everyone in the world. Now, to that end, I proposed yesterday a four-point policy, which I would like to repeat to you within the context of what I have just said. First, every effort in cooperation with the United Nations to bring an end to hostilities in the Middle East, for the President has clearly stated that our national policy does not favor hostilities to resolve the causes of international tension or of international injustice. Second, this time the end of hostilities should be implemented. I emphasize this time, for we've had almost this situation before. Not as big, but almost the same situation before. This time the end of hostilities should be implemented to prevent the recurrence of the intolerable provocations border incursions, the barring of the Suez Canal to use by Israeli ships, and the other military actions directed at Israel by its Arab neighbors, which have provoked the present situation. Third, the United States should bring its immense prestige to bear in getting the United Nations to exercise its full authority within the United Nations Charter, and should extend, that is, our country should extend, its full cooperation toward that end. And fourth, I see as an element in this whole situation, the conclusion of a U.S.-Israel mutual defense agreement as soon as possible, patterned after the mutual defense agreement which we have with the Republic of China on Formosa. Now, above all, in this whole situation, we must realize that we may now be dealing with a great deal more than the Middle East. We may be dealing with the peace of the whole world. Every move we make must have as its objective the prevention of any large-scale war in which the United States could become involved. And I suggested at lunch today, and I would like to repeat here, that the kind of cooperation that I envision between the United States and what this great parliament of man, the United Nations General Assembly, should decide will require, and may require, a great mobilization of non-military resources on the part of our country. Perhaps extensive help with money, with food, with shipping, that we should be prepared as people to perform this humanitarian and leadership role which we have in the world in terms of maintaining and fortifying the peace to the extent of the willingness to engage resources in that fashion. Now, my friends, I speak so soberly because I have had a long history in this field. Since the efforts to establish Israel began, from the moment I was elected to the Congress in 1946, I sought to aid Israel in every way, because it may interest you to know that I was a member of the Displaced Persons Committee of the House, which went through the European camps in 1947 and saw how very difficult was that situation. In addition, I've always realized that this was the crossroads of the world, and that dependable allies, vital to our own and free world security, were extremely important. And I've always considered Israel a very dependable ally. I visited there to learn the needs at first hand, and I worked to obtain financial aid in the mutual security program when it first came up, and have also persistently sought to keep Israel capable of defending itself against menacing neighbors, and indeed have disagreed with our own State Department on the subject of the supply of arms and the consummation of a United States mutual defense agreement, a consummation which I hope will come now. And for the last few months, I've tried to help in connection with a $75 million export-import bank loan for peaceful irrigation there, which is in the cards. Now, my friends, I repeat those facts because I think that every American feels the sympathy which is involved in this situation. And at the same time, every American feels the portentous implications of American policy in terms of world peace, In short, we can understand, and at the same time, we must act as the world leader and consonant with our world responsibilities. I deeply feel that the President has put these ideas and the fundamental philosophy in focus in his speech. And I feel also that the ideas of implementation which I have advanced, the ideas of implementation which others will unquestionably advance, in the same spirit of maintaining the peace and at the same time doing everything we humanly can to implement what must be a solution to this problem which poses such grave threats to all of us. I hope very much that this will be the spirit and the temper in which the subject will be discussed. It comes very late in the campaign. It seems to me that just about all the evidence is in on competence, on policy, etc., and that this is a great national issue which needs more than anything else that same kind of responsibility, the same kind of thinking, the same way of speaking that any of us would be expected to engage in if we were in the House of Representatives or in the Senate and the same crisis broke upon the country. And I feel very deeply, and I speak to you tonight in those terms, I feel very deeply that this is the only thing that's fitting to the occasion, even if it is campaign time, and even if the people have to make an election decision. This is yet an occasion when we must act and speak and deliberate in exactly the same way that we would if any of us were in office. I think the President did that and spoke as a President first and as a candidate second. And this, it seems to me, is the acid test in our country. And I hope very much, and the people can't, after all, help judging character and competence and purpose and ideas all the time before an election. This is inherent in the situation. There's nothing we can do about it. We certainly don't have to fan the flames by bitter partisan debate at a time when the country normally and without a campaign would be closing ranks as Americans always do when faced with a difficult situation in which always the finest qualities of the country have come out, which developed the great bipartisan foreign policy in 1944 with Cordell Hull and Arthur Vandenberg, and which has in our recurring crises, always when the crisis was on, had exactly the same effect. I can only hope that this will be the case now. And I can assure you, as fellow Republicans, that as far as I'm concerned, it shall be the case. Thank you very much.